Almost good afternoon, Your Honors. Henry Hyman, Cooch & Taylor for the appellants, Jennerette Drecka and her husband, Christopher. I'd like to introduce you to two members of Cooch & Taylor who are here with me at council table, Bennett Blakely and Basil Colias.
Welcome.
There is no question that Jennerette Drecka is an innocent litigant, nor that she is unquestionably entitled to compensation from the defendant Hitchens, who has admitted liability, if not the other defendants. What occurred is undisputed. A truck tire, which came off of a large truck, bounced over a median strip into Ms. Drecka's vehicle, which came to a rest and then was struck again. She went to the ER immediately and then went to Dr. DuShuttle within the week after the accident. After Dr. DuShuttle began treating Ms. Drecka, he decided that she would benefit from the modalities which would be provided by the Pain Management and Rehabilitation PA, a clinic which is operated by Dr. Ganesh Ballou. Dr. DuShuttle referred Ms. Drecka to Dr. Ballou, who in coordination with Dr. DuShuttle treated Ms. Drecka from January 27th, 06 to January 6th, 07. The medical records are replete with references to Ms. Drecka's unremarkable prior medical history and to the symptoms for which she was being treated by Dr. DuShuttle and by Dr. Ballou. The trial judge terminated Ms. Drecka's litigation.
Mr. Hyman,
yes, sir.
I think we all understand that the critical facts here have to do with whether or not an expert report or a summary of the expert's expected trial's testimony was had to be filed.
Yes, sir.
And had to be filed on or before the deadline set forth in the trial court's order. A couple of questions. In your briefs, one of the arguments that I understand you to be making is that the rule that requires that type of report doesn't apply to treating physicians, and the reason it doesn't apply to treating physicians, or one reason, is that for the most part, those physicians are fact witnesses. That is, they were actors, in the post-accident trauma and would be testifying about the course of treatment. To that extent, without elaborating, is that part of your position? That essentially the treating physicians are not up there as experts, are not going to be called as experts?
I think, Your Honor, in the rule that I believe Your Honor is referring to is 26B4. And 26B4 is trial preparation experts. And it talks about two different kinds of experts. Those that are acquired or developed in anticipation of litigation or for trial are the ones that are referenced in this rule. And the reason for that is that in order to be able to
Let's stop right there for a minute. One argument that your side makes is that the treating physicians were not retained in anticipation of litigation.
That's true.
They were there to treat the injury that took place.
So
if the rule applies, it would apply for the reason that that notwithstanding the fact that they were treating physicians, they're going to be called to give expert testimony at the trial.
I believe that's an accurate statement, Your Honor.
And is it or is it not your position that the testimony that you were going to call these treating physicians to give was not expert testimony, or was it?
I believe it is expert testimony, Your Honor.
I
believe it is expert
testimony. It is expert testimony.
The difference between a 701 witness and a 702 witness, which discusses experts, it lies in the response to how they are hired or for whom they are hired. If they are hired for the purpose acquired or developed in anticipation of litigation or for trial, they must file a report because that report is necessary for the other side to be able to cross-examine or to understand.
So you're saying that because these two physicians were not initially retained for the purpose of testifying at trial, the fact that they are now being asked or post-treatment or during the course of treatment being asked to testify at trial does not bring them within the rule?
That's correct, Your Honor.
Even though the testimony that they would be giving, that is the opinion testimony they would be giving, is no different from the testimony that they would be giving had they been retained for purposes of trial.
Well, that I can't know, Your Honor. But I do know that people who are retained for purposes of trial are retained in a way that is different or for a different purpose than those who are retained for treatment.
Well, what is the, functionally, why should one category be covered by the rule and not the other?
Because a physician who is hired in order to deal with trial testimony, as Dr. Myers was, is hired for a specific purpose which is not, by his own statements, create a doctor-patient relationship, does not create any kind of treatment options, is an examination, which is required by the rules, or can be required by the rules. The absence of presenting somebody for an examination is one of the bases for having a problem. But his decision, and he says so in his last paragraph, is I am an independent medical examiner. My opinions are independent of who hired me. There's no relationship. He has no medical relationship to the patient.
Let's cut through this and get to the point of, or at least one of the purposes of the rule. To the extent that the two physicians at issue in this case were going to testify about what they did as treating physicians, that's fact.
Yes, sir.
And presumably the medical records that your side submitted would give the other side, the defense, some idea of the nature of their testimony. That is,
I think it would give them the totality of the nature of their testimony.
Well, let's not jump ahead too quick, because I'm distinguishing between their testimony, their factual testimony as treating physicians, which goes to historical fact, and their opinion testimony as experts, which deal with issues such as causation.
Yes, sir.
How, as a general matter, would the medical records give the defense notice, fair notice, of what these physicians would be testifying to in their role as experts?
If I could just call your attention as an example to the Appendix A49, which is the pain management and rehabilitation report from Dr. Ballou, which talks of the motor vehicle accident and the her prehistory of non-medical involvement. And he spells out exactly what happened. Seatbelt driver of a car, patients collided against a loose tire off of a concrete truck that crossed the median.
Yes, I think
the whole thing is there, Your Honor.
Well, but isn't that really just the doctor taking down notes, on his notes, the history as recited by the plaintiff?
There are notes in the doctor's when he does his S symptoms and causation and the rest, and he has an arrow that says SP MVA. which is the symptoms are caused by the motor vehicle accident. And that is in...
Well, that's what he was told.
No, that's what his... Those were the notes...
How do we know that that's his opinion as distinguished between what his patient told him?
Well, I guess that there's two ways, Your Honor. It would either be at an examination, at trial, or at a deposition, or through interrogatories.
Is this an argument that you raised to the trial court?
I believe so, Your Honor. I know that that's been an issue that was raised by the appellees. When Dr. Ballou's report was rejected because of his failure to have a summary report, the argument was raised that the notes, that is the doctor's notes, which would, I guess, include Dr. Duchuttle's notes, because that became part of it, were rejected out of hand by the court. The appellant argued that those notes were sufficient to provide the notice to the appellees, or in that case the defendants, of the decisions, opinions, and fact basis of...
At any point did you raise the idea that these were treating physicians and therefore they did not have to comply with the expert limitations on timing?
I think that was part, Your Honor, and I don't have it in front of me, of the response to the motion for in limine.
Would there be a record of that?
I believe so, Your Honor. I will look for it. If I can find it, I will advise the court during my rebuttal time.
Okay. The other question I have is with respect to this treating physicians dealt with differently than experts.
Yes, Your Honor.
If, as you say, the idea behind the distinction is that treating physician is the person who knows facts about the patient's condition and what the patient told him or her about what happened that brought them to the doctor. So for purposes of being a witness and saying, I treated this person X number of times, and the first time she came in, she looked like this, and she had these problems, and so on, that would all be part of being a fact witness, right?
That's correct, Your Honor.
Okay. If during that same line of testimony, you get to the end after you've asked the doctor all about the number of times you've seen the witness, the plaintiff, and the nature of the injuries and so forth, if at the end you say, now, doctor, in your opinion as a medical expert or as a doctor, what is your view as to how these injuries came about? Wouldn't that be asking for something other than a fact
I think
inquiry?
I believe, Your Honor, that the issue of causation, which is, I think, what we're talking about, is expert opinion.
Okay. So if it's expert opinion, how do you get it out of the rules for experts?
Because that's what the rule says. 26B4 talks about information otherwise discoverable, acquired or developed in anticipation of litigation or for trial. The defendant's counsel had everything it needed in order to cross-examine the doctors and, in fact, had everything it needed in order to obtain a so-called independent medical examination.
But isn't there a difference between information and expert opinion?
Doctors are so different than other types of experts and consultants that it's hard for me to give you a straight, simple answer to that question. Everything they do, every treatment they make, contains within it their expertise. Everything they write down contains what they believe is the appropriate treatment, which is based on their expertise. So when you ask me, are the facts separate from expertise, I don't know that I can answer the question in a way that makes it simple. I know that they being the defendants, had every opportunity to examine the doctors. They had every opportunity to examine the witness, the plaintiff. They had everything they needed.
Mr. Hyman?
Yes, sir.
The other side quotes in their brief, or has this sentence, Federal Rule of Civil Procedure 26 indicates that although expert reports are generally not required of treating physicians to testify regarding treatment, a number of courts require an expert report when a treating physician will offer testimony as to causation. And they cite a Seventh Circuit case and a Northern District of Illinois case. Do you agree as a matter of law with that, or is there a different view of other courts that you would urge us to follow?
I think there's different views from other courts.
And which courts should we follow?
I think the issue becomes now involved with the sanction aspect of it. Because whether the report is required or not also falls into the sanction issue of whether the court should have warned, should have given caution, should have given an opportunity to the plaintiffs. In other words, a sanction less than dismissal for what had occurred.
Well, before we get there, the rule should be what? That you do not even have to provide a report on causation? Is that your position?
Again, I'm troubled by the way the question is phrased because I can't necessarily answer it. The notes that were produced show causation. The notes that are contained and were produced to the defendants have within them the expertise of the doctor. Everything that was needed for cross-examination or for them to come to a decision or for their own doctor to come to a decision was contained within the notes.
You're well within your rebuttal time.
I understand that.
Welcome to continue to use it.
Okay, I just call to the court's attention Hogue versus Amex Assurance Company.
May it please the court. Good afternoon, Justices Berger, Jacobs, and Ridgely. My name is Jeff Friedman on behalf of the Hitchens defendant. This is a case in which it is clear what didn't happen. And what didn't happen is that there was no disclosure of the opinions held by Drs. Ballou and later Dr. Duchotel. What there was a very minimal disclosure in response to interrogatories that were propounded on the expert issue, and specifically Ms. Draco's counsel responded when called to identify expert witnesses. They simply said, we'll call all experts. That was the response. There was no indication as to who those experts were, nor to what their opinions would be.
Well, they referred to treating physicians, didn't they?
They did, but they didn't identify who the treating physicians were. They didn't identify what the treating physicians would say. They simply said all treating physicians. It takes very little additional effort to simply tell us what they're going to say.
But you had the medical records. Don't they give you the name of a physician?
They do give us the name of the physician. They don't tell us whether that physician is going to be called as an expert witness.
That's true, but let me ask you a different question, which is did your side do any medical investigation? In other words, did a doctor on your behalf review the medical records and or examine the plaintiff?
That did happen. Dr. Myers performed an examination.
And did Dr. Myers conclude that her injuries were not the result of this accident?
No, Dr. Myers concluded that there was an injury resulted from this event. The problem is in how these cases progress. If I can focus back on the medical record from Dr. Ballou that Mr. Hyman held up, I think it was page A49 from the appendix, there's a notation that talks about SPMVA. There's no indication as to what that means. Does that mean that there's one diagnosis that is status post-motor vehicle accident? Are there two? Does that mean that the plaintiff said, hey, I was in a car accident? Does that mean that the doctor actually holds the opinion that these events occurred as a result of the collision? I can tell you in reviewing the medical records produced, as did Judge Abelman in reviewing the records, that there is zero opinion regarding causation other than a notation that says SP/MVA or S/P.
Well, there's three.
Go ahead.
three diagnoses in the report: cervical strain post MVA 82405, lumbar strain post MVA 82405, costochondritis resolved post MVA. Now, did your expert agree with all of those?
My expert agreed, the defense expert agreed, I should say, that there was an injury resulting from the collision. I can't tell you specifically if there was a unanimity of diagnoses as listed in that record.
So your expert did not say there was cervical strain post?
My expert said there was an injury. I don't know if he used the phrase cervical strain. There was certainly an injury to the neck that my expert, the defense expert, excuse me.
Well, injury to the neck is cervical strain.
I just don't know if he said cervical strain.
Well, line question on this issue is, tell me how you were prejudiced as a result of not having the detailed letter report that you suggest is required.
Sure. The prejudice is in exactly what happened in this case. I'm going to back up a moment, if I may. The appellant in this case looks to cases outside of Delaware to explain why they don't need to disclose medical opinions.
Federal cases, right?
Correct, but they also look to other jurisdictions. But there are plenty of cases within this jurisdiction and coming out of this court that hold that treating doctor opinions must be disclosed. One of the cases, and I promise to get to your actual question about prejudice, but I want to back up to talk about the holdings. If you go back to the Bush case, the Russell case, and the Duncan case, all of these cases hold that treating doctor opinions must be disclosed. And in each of those cases,
Is this specific issue under 26B4 and the commentary raised in those cases?
I'm sorry.
Was the specific issue about whether treating physicians are 26B4 witnesses, according to the federal commentary, raised in those cases?
I don't believe specifically, but it establishes the custom and practice in the state of Delaware, in Delaware cases, to have those opinions disclosed to prevent a lack of prejudice, which I'm not going to talk to you about. The prejudice is that defense counsel or opposing counsel, as the case may be, is faced with two or three different options. One is to know that nothing has been disclosed and then to, in response, do nothing yourself, to run afoul or potentially run afoul of the trial judge's case scheduling order, and to hope that the trial judge will not penalize the defendant for not doing anything. That's not a viable option for most counsel. The other option is to sort of willy-nilly get a medical exam without really knowing what you're defending. And unfortunately, that is what sometimes has to occur to avoid the prejudice of doing nothing and running afoul of the trial judge's case scheduling order.
So did you file an expert report?
We did obtain a report, and it was produced in accordance with the rules of discovery.
So you filed it?
I'm not sure it was filed on the court docket, but it was disclosed.
Okay. And is it your? Am I understanding you correctly in saying that the way it should be worked is that the plaintiff has to submit its expert reports, and then you get to respond to them? And for you to have to put in your expert's opinion before having seen the plaintiff's expert opinion, you're A, doing it a little bit blind, and B, giving them an outline of what they need to cover to rebut your report.
That is exactly what I'm saying, with one caveat. Your Honor asked if I would request a report. I simply, as the opposing counsel, want disclosure of the opinions. It's not a hang-up about needing an actual legal report, simply a disclosure of what that doctor's opinion is going to be at trial so it can be responded to.
Is it, when the report, the expert report, is disclosed in the course of discovery, is it the custom or practice to then take the deposition of the expert?
That is not the custom. That certainly occurs, but and that gets back to one other prejudice that happens in these cases, is it becomes cost prohibitive. In this case, we're really talking about two doctors.
Okay. Well, in terms of prejudice, if you're prejudiced, it has to do with what response, if any, you will be making to the expert report. And I gather there are only two responses if you're not taking a deposition. One is cross-examination at trial, and the other would be preparing your own expert witness and instructing that witness as to what needs to be covered, which would be informed by the other side's expert report.
True. For instance, in this case, when the medical exam by the defense was obtained, there's no indication of whether or not the plaintiff is even claiming a permanent injury. We don't know. We have to act or run afoul of the trial court's case scheduling order and potentially put our own clients at risk.
I'm just trying to what I'm really asking, and I suspect the other justices were too, is to get you to articulate clearly and simply what the prejudice is.
The prejudice is that you have to act blindly without full disclosure from the plaintiff or the opposing counsel, as to what opinions they are going to set forth at trial.
Okay, which hampers your cross-examination.
It hampers cross-examination, trial preparation. It hampers the decision about which expert, if any, you are going to obtain to oppose the case.
And I assume, I believe the other side's response to that would be, well, you can ask contention interrogatories to find out the information you need.
Well, that was done in this case. Expert interrogatories were requested, and the response was, see medical records.
Was that an accurate answer in compliance with your request or not?
That was woefully inadequate.
And did you move to compel a response?
I don't believe a motion to compel was filed. I believe the next thing that happened was that we were at a motion in limine status. I am not certain of that, Your Honor.
But you could have filed
Certainly.
A motion to compel.
Certainly.
But what I'm asking about is there a tactic involved here where you have an answer that you know is inadequate and you let the clock run and then you move to dismiss? I mean, is that the tactic that's being used?
No, I don't think so at all, Your Honor. The tactic is to ask the plaintiff's counsel to do their job, or opposing counsel as the case may be, and to disclose the opinions. And I think in one of the submissions there was a report submitted by Dr. Ballou that resulted from what appears to be conversation from the problem here, Your Honor, is none of us were in the underlying counsel. Everyone appears to have moved on. But there were conversations between Ms. Dreka's prior attorney and Hitchens' prior attorney, which led to the submission of a late report by Dr. Ballou. There's no stall tactic to hopefully dismiss the case. That's not what is going on. What we're asking for, Your Honor, and what I think Mr. Hyman alluded to, is the thought that defendants can take the deposition to find out what is going on. I alluded to the fact that that's a potentially cost prohibitive exercise, but also Judge Graves in the Duncan case noted that that's not the job of opposing counsel to go on what he says is a wild goose chase.
Yeah, but one option would have been for your side to take the deposition of the two physicians and then move to have the cost of those depositions shifted to the plaintiff as a sanction.
Your Honor, I suppose that is an option. That does require defense counsel to lay out the funds initially. And in a case where there's two doctors, we know what those costs potentially might be. Some cases might have 10 or 20 doctors.
What to be very precise about it, would be within your power, your side's power, and the court's power to order that a deposition be taken with the cost being paid up front by the plaintiffs.
Your Honor,
so you would not have to outlay any money.
Your Honor, in theory, that is an option. I don't believe that's the customer practice of
Well, we're not talking about the customer practice. We're talking about what should have happened in this case and whether something short of an outright dismissal of the plaintiff's case should have occurred.
Well, Your Honor, what should have happened is that the opinions of the treating physicians ought to have been disclosed in accordance with Delaware law, and then we wouldn't be here today.
Yeah, but you're not going to tell us that this is the first time somebody didn't meet the discovery deadline on an expert, right?
Certainly not. There's cases that talk about, I think there's one of the cases we cited that talks about a one-day delay. And certainly in practice, People ask for extensions of time, and those are always liberally granted by counsel that handle these cases. But certainly I'm not standing before you suggesting to you that every time there's a failure of the deadline, the case is dismissed.
Well, how bad was it in this case? Were there multiple extensions that you granted that were ignored, and you were now 2 weeks from trial, or what?
Your Honor, what happened in this case, to my understanding, is that there was little compliance with the court's rulings as to the case scheduling order. There was an attempt by, I'm going to take a larger picture, an attempt by the plaintiff to take Dr. Myers' deposition without noticing any of the counsel involved, and nor without contacting Dr. Myers.
Well, let me put it this way, because you're almost out of time. At the point at which the trial court dismissed the case as a sanction, what was that date compared to the trial date that had been scheduled?
Your Honor, I am not certain of the two
in terms
dates.
Of months or weeks or anything?
Well, I know that pretrial stipulation had been filed, so I believe we were within 2 months. But, Your Honor, I am not certain of those dates. Your Honor,
let me ask you one question about the scheduling order itself. It actually says, plaintiff's expert report, parenthesis, or Rule 26b-4 disclosure, close parenthesis, deadline, and then it's got a date. Now, does that mean the same thing? Plaintiff's expert report, meaning a Rule 26b-4 disclosure?
I don't think so, Your Honor. I think the report means a legal stylized report from the physician. The disclosure simply means the attorney writing a letter to the other attorneys involved saying what the report's going to say, or in lieu of the report, what the opinions are going to be, I should say.
But if the Rule 26b-4 disclosure is what is meant by that, and if the treating physician is not subject to that, then there's no violation of that deadline.
Well, then we have to go to the case law that is in play, which is the Bush case, the Russell case, the Duncan case, and the case out of the federal court in Illinois, which you alluded to earlier. Those cases in the Delaware case law hold that the treating physician's opinion have to be disclosed as a precursor to admission at trial. And
thank you. Your time is up.
Thank you.
May it please the court. Good afternoon, Justice Berger, Jacobs, and Ridgely. My name is Ron Hardin, Jr. of the firm Rieker, Rizzo, and Darnell in Wilmington, and I'm here on behalf of the appellees / cross-appellants Atlantic Concrete and David Wood. As an introductory matter, I would just like to state that I echo the sentiments of Mr. Friedman, who represents the other appellee in this case, and I will focus my time on the cross-appeal that was filed by my client in regards to this matter. As the justices are aware, the cross-appeal is in regards to a summary judgment motion that was filed by my former colleague, underlying counsel in this case, asking that the case be dismissed due to lack of any liability on my clients. The only evidence that was ever presented in this case regarding...
Which the court denied, right?
Yes, Justice Jacobs. The court did deny the motion for summary judgment, which gives rise to the cross-appeal. The only evidence that's been presented in the underlying case regarding liability in this case is the testimony of Mr. Hitchens. And he essentially has said that his company takes full responsibility because they were the ones that did the work on the truck before the accident occurred, and that no matter what type of inspection could have been done, there would have never been an ability to find that the lug nuts were stripped. Even if you did an inspection of each lug nut, you would not have been able to determine that the lug nuts were loose at the time of doing a pre-trip inspection. In the opinion written by Judge Abelman regarding this motion, and during the actual motion presentation, which again my colleague attended as he was attorney of record at the time, Judge Abelman, as well as the appellants in their opening brief and reply brief, make reference to various speculations they're speculating that the jury could find this, or the jury could decide that the inspection wasn't good enough, or that there could have been more that was done. However, our position is that those types of things are beyond the common knowledge of a lay person, and therefore would require expert testimony to say what the standard is for determining what is a reasonable inspection of a concrete truck prior to going out onto the roadways of the state of Delaware. So in regards to the hierarchy of things that need to be found in order to determine liability on a party, you need to find an existence of a duty, a breach of that duty, approximate cause, and then damages. There's no testimony or evidence that even reflects the existence of a duty. All it is speculation on the part of the appellants, as well as Judge Abelman in her soliloquy with Mr. Stewart, who was prior counsel, and in her opinion. We don't have anything to even show whether or not there is a duty in this case, and so that we don't even get to whether there was a breach of the duty. And so essentially that's our position. I wish I could come before you and say there's other evidence or anything like that, but at the end of the day, the evidence that was presented to the court is as I discussed to you this afternoon. It's Mr. Hitchens saying, we take responsibility, we're the ones that messed up. You couldn't have found out that the wheel was going to be loose regardless of what you did, and there's no other evidence. So our position is that there were no issues of material fact in this case, and therefore summary judgment was proper in regards to liability on behalf of my clients, Atlantic Concrete and Mr. Wood. In summing up, I would just say that, again, my client's position is that we believe the appeal of the underlying or the underlying appeal should be rejected. But if this court does deem that the appellants do have a valid appeal, then we would just ask that the cross appeal be granted on behalf of our clients and that the case be dismissed against Atlantic Concrete and Mr. Wood. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Good afternoon again. I realize my time is brief. I'd like to first address the question of what jurisdictions do run counter to Illinois. And I believe that if the court would look at page 10 in footnote 30 of our brief, you will see a commentary from the 93 amendments to the rule. In addition, we have cases cited from Massachusetts, Idaho, Vermont, New York, D.C., Pennsylvania, Colorado, New Hampshire, and Puerto Rico that, in fact, support our position. The rules in the Moore's federal practice says very specifically that treating physicians are exempt from the requirement of reports. Whether that carries weight with this court is, of course, up to the court's discretion.
And I would like to read. Have you found where you raised this issue below?
I did not, Your Honor.
So should we assume that you did not raise this issue below?
I guess that has to be the assumption to be made because I cannot find any specific item, although, as I indicated to the court, I think that was implicit in the decision of the trial judge below.
If it was not raised below, why should we address it now, given our Rule 8?
Because it will continue then to be the rule of law that will be controlling in this jurisdiction. Everybody will look to that decision to make the decision that follows. I think it is important as a case of, I assume, first impression to indicate treating physicians do not have the requirement that hired physicians for the trial do have. That is, they are treated differently. They're a subset.
You're saying it's in the interest of justice for us to decide the issue anyway because it's a recurring problem.
Yes, sir.
With respect to the cross appeal, assuming you prevail and you're back in a trial mode, why should Atlantic be kept in this case?
Well, the basis of a motion for summary judgment is that there is no issue of material fact, and as a matter of law, they're entitled. I don't think they meet that standard. I think there are, just because one party, one defendant.
Wait a second. Give me a fact that is in dispute, that's material.
The jury could decide that notwithstanding the Hitchens commentary that the driver and or his employer should have looked at the nuts and should have made a decision.
Well, is that
with no evidence they're supposed to reach that conclusion?
No, of course not, Your Honor.
Well, but the thing is, at this point, you have some obligation to come forward with something that says, "Oh, wait a second, there's an issue to be in dispute. Tell me what facts there are to suggest that this evidence that we have is disputed."
I can't do it, Your Honor. I don't have it at my hand.
So summary judgment should have been granted.
I disagree, but I can't find facts that would support your position.
But do you agree that there's no expert witness to show that what the particular duties would be for someone to make this inspection?
I do not believe that the appellee below indicated any 702 expert with regard to the trial order showed that there was going to be an expert. I don't believe that there was any indication even that there was going to be a 701 expert with a lay opinion. So my answer is I don't know whether there would have been an issue and would have been an expert with regard to that that would have been retained.
But at least on that point, no expert was identified within the time frame of the trial scheduling.
Not to my knowledge, Your Honor, by anybody. Okay. And I think I'm over the top.
We'll take your arguments under consideration, and we'll take a short recess.